I'm John Kroll. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Civil War and of Abraham Lincoln's death. The Indiana State Museum will mark the anniversary of the death of America's greatest president with a special Abraham Lincoln exhibit and gala called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Loss. My guests will be the museum's senior vice president, Susanna Kerber, and curator Dale Ogden. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. And Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. Well, if you are a Civil War buff or an Abraham Lincoln buff, this is the show for you. And I would encourage you to call in at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. We're going to be talking about the Indiana State Museum's upcoming new exhibit and gala about Abraham Lincoln called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Loss. My guests are returning a veteran of the show now, Susanna Kerber, who is the museum's senior vice president and curator for the museum, Dale Ogden. Welcome, both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. So tell me about the exhibit here. I got to admit, I'm probably going to get a little fanboy on this because I've always been fascinated by Lincoln. But tell me what is going to be part of it, what we're going to be looking at.
Sure. As you say, we're in the 150th anniversary here of the end of the Lincoln administration, and pretty much everybody from the Smithsonian to Ken Burns to Indiana University is doing some sort of project that relates to that sesquicentennial. And just by nature, a lot of the projects revolve around the assassination. I mean, that's what makes sense. It's sort of the end of the story, so to speak.
In some ways, not.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Most people are familiar to some extent with the assassination. They know that Lincoln went to Ford's Theater. They know that he was shot by John Wilkes Booth. They know that he died. Mm. And at that point, people say, I know all about Lincoln's assassination. What we're trying to do with this exhibition, I think, is put his death in the context of the times, in the context of the Civil War, in the context of the way people dealt with issues of life and death during the 19th century. Death was a common part of what people dealt with in the 19th century. People died. Mm-hmm. They died all the time. Infant mortality or childhood mortality approached 30%. Mm-hmm. People were used to friends, family, neighbors dying. The Civil War really changed that dynamic a lot because when American males made it through childhood, they generally had a pretty good chance of living a long life. Once you made it through measles and diphtheria and a lot of the childhood diseases of the time, you had a reasonable chance of living 50, 60, 70 years. The Civil War really changed that. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly you had hundreds of thousands of otherwise healthy young men dying. And that obviously had an impact on the culture. It had an impact on the way people felt about the war, obviously, but about patriotism, about the nature of God, about pretty much every kind of fundamental life and death issue that you can imagine. As the war's coming to an end and people feel that they have been able to at least come to terms mm-hmm. on what this was about, suddenly you have the President of the United States assassinated, the first time in American history that had happened. The 15 presidents before him had not been murdered. So then you have a whole new sort of set of circumstances for America to deal with. Mm-hmm. And the nature of the conversation, the civic conversation, was much different because of that dynamic. The other variable that comes into play there is telegraphy.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time, the entire nation could essentially experience the same traumatic event simultaneously. It didn't take 3 weeks or 2 months for the news to reach San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole country, as really had never happened before, was having the same conversation about the same traumatic event at the same time and trying to process all this information. So we're trying to put Lincoln's death and how it affected really not only the culture and not only the society, but the civic conversation in context of the 19th century and in context of the Civil War.
Susanna, why was this important for the museum as an exhibit rather than doing something sort of just saying on overall on the Civil War? Why was the focus on Lincoln?
The museum is the steward of the Lincoln Financial Foundation collection, which was given to the state of Indiana by Lincoln Financial back at the end of 2008. And we co-curate that collection with the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne. And so it's always accessible to scholars, but we also want to make sure that it's accessible through exhibitions. So we've committed to every 2 to 3 years, we do a major exhibition that uses that collection and uses it in relation to other materials. So in this case, we looked at some of the very strong materials we had related to the Civil War and to this whole issue of mortality that were in the main collection of the Indiana State Museum. And so that's where the impetus for the objects and feeling that we knew people would be looking to us with the sesquicentennial, the end of the Civil War and Lincoln's assassination, there would be an expectation that we would do something that would address those. And so we thought, well, what, as Dale said, what can we do that's a little bit different take and gives people a different context for those otherwise somewhat familiar events?
We are talking today on No Limits about the Indiana State Museum's new exhibit on Abraham Lincoln in honor of the 150th anniversary of his death. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Dale, I'm coming to the exhibit. Walk me through what I'm going to experience there.
Sure. The first part of the exhibition, the first, I'd say, third of the exhibition, is that 19th century context that I was talking about. Just the fact that people dealt with death on a regular basis. It was part of their normal life. You didn't get to be 20 years old and have never known anybody who ever passed away.
Yeah, I think Gary Wills, who wrote a great book on Lincoln, made reference to it as a cult of death at that time, you know, with a celebration of mourning almost, with the black armbands and
well, and you get into Victorian mourning. Mm-hmm. Queen Victoria's husband died mm-hmm. relatively young in 1861, and Victoria made a cult, if you will, mm-hmm. Of mourning. And since Victoria was sort of the leading trendsetter of her time and the British, you know, followed her lead, America looked to England for similar kind of rituals and experiences. And I hadn't really thought about it as a cult of death, but I think that's apt. Today, you know, you can mm-hmm. have a child in high school, a child in college who has never really directly experienced death. They might still have grandparents that are living. Their parents are probably living.
Great-grandparents.
Even great-grandparents. Their siblings are still living. They don't really have the context of mm-hmm. people passed away on a regular basis, and it was something that you dealt with. Death was a part of life. And the first part of the exhibition kind of deals with that, deals with mourning, deals with the fact that people had to have, you know, special clothing in some instances to deal with death. Just the fact that, you know, there were orphans, which we don't really see on a typical basis anymore. So the first part of the exhibition just kind of deals with death as a fact of life mm-hmm. in the 19th century. The second part of the exhibition then is almost exclusively about the Civil War itself, mm-hmm. and about how that really changed the nature of what people felt was likely to be a part of their life. I mean, you didn't expect Junior at the age of 21 to suddenly just not be there anymore. I mean, he was expected to live. And the Civil War was so incredibly violent and so incredibly traumatic for the country, including civilians. More people died in the Civil War than all the rest of American conflicts combined.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that was due to disease. It wasn't just people getting shot on the battlefield. You suddenly had large numbers of people crowded into unsanitary camps or living in essentially the same tents and that kind of thing. So disease actually killed twice as many people as combat did in the Civil War. But regardless, you're still talking about three quarters of a million people who died during the Civil War.
Well, and the battles themselves were bloodbaths. I mean, we really, you know, I remember somewhere seeing the figure that if, you know, in a conflict in the 20th century, if you had, you know, 10% casualties during the course of the fight, that was considered horrific.
Right.
And most of the battles in the Civil War, the casualty rates were north of 25%,
yeah.
sometimes approaching 40%. And, you know, that was just, we can't imagine what the slaughter must have been like.
The estimate that I've seen recently is that about 20% of Southern white males of military age, you're talking 18 to late 40s,
mm-hmm.
One out of every five did not survive the war. If you extrapolate the numbers into today's population,
yeah.
you're talking about 8 million deaths.
Whoa.
Yeah. We had, what, 4,500, 5,000 related to 9-1-1?
Yeah.
And we know what kind of...
What a trauma
that was, and the impact that it's had on America in so many different ways. As I say, everything from political to social to religious, the impact that those 4,500 casualties had. Can you imagine 8 million?
Yeah.
You know, and it did have an impact on America of the mid-19th century.
Yeah, it's like, in some ways, we look back on that period, and I remember taking part in a public event down in southern Indiana, and actually somebody made reference to sort of that those were the good old days. and I thought, well, wait a second, we got brothers and cousins killing each other by the tens of thousands here,
yeah.
neighbors, fellow countrymen. It's just this enormous cataclysm right in the middle of the 19th century. It's kind of a minor miracle, isn't it, Susanna, that the country survived it?
It is. And another really interesting aspect of this show that Dale has alluded to is that the mourning went from being primarily a private event, although it had this public mm-hmm. face with the mourning ritual, to being a public event. And you look at, and this is reflected in the objects in the collection, but you look at, there's still all the personal mementos, but you have the popular prints mm-hmm. suddenly that are depicting battles that come out both during and then far after the war, because people are trying to make sense of a public event as a group. You have photography. I mean, it's not just telegraphy that's a technology that makes a change. With photography, Matthew Brady can have an exhibition of the dead on the battlefield of Antietam within a month of the battle's end. You mm-hmm. can go into his gallery in New York City and buy photographs that show the aftermath. So it really is hard to explain just what a difference it made in terms of people's expectations of how you were going to deal with death, sort that you wouldn't see your loved one's death. You wouldn't maybe even know that they were dead for sure. So the whole process of mourning gets turned upside down. And you have a whole country that's trying to grapple with these things at the same time.
And the fact that often those deaths were occurring way far from home.
Way far from home.
And in some ways you look at it, I mean, it sounds like, and I hesitate to put words in your mouths here, but in some ways it sounds like the exhibition is designed to try to get modern Americans to step into that context and understand why those events were occurring. That, for example, we're going to talk about the second inaugural a little later, but the Gettysburg Address at some level was an attempt by Lincoln to say, this is why it is worth it. This is why, you know, we've got all of these deaths here. This is why it is worth it. Dale, is it fair to say that that's what you're trying to do, is get us back into the 19th century?
That's I think that's a very good summation of what we attempt to do. As a historian, you know, I like the names, dates, and places, because mm-hmm. that's what I do. But I understand why that's not really compelling for the casual person. We're looking to be more experiential here.
We are talking about the Indiana State Museum's new Abraham Lincoln exhibition and gala called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Lost. My name is John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Indiana State Museum's new exhibition on Abraham Lincoln called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Loss. My guests are Susanna Kerber, who is the museum's senior vice president, and curator Dale Ogden. Well, we were talking beforehand about, you know, sort of how the Civil War changed. It's not just perceptions of death, but really how we as a country and as a culture processed death, how we dealt with it. And you can see that to some degree. I mean, I guess in the parts where, you know, where you're focusing exclusively on Lincoln, is the focus going to be on sort of the last days of his life? Because among other things, we're coming up on the 150th anniversary also of the second inaugural, which is perhaps the only speech that sort of stands with a Gettysburg Address in American history, at least belongs on the same shelf. And that, I sort of anticipates. I mean, it deals with a similar theme. He's obviously saying, you know, both sides, North and South, prayed to the same God. Both of them have dealt with these horrible tragedies. You know, we have to somehow try to make sense of this. Dale?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the second inaugural, because actually that is my favorite writing of Abraham Lincoln and probably my favorite document in American history. I think it is just so incredibly powerful. I mean, it's written by Abraham Lincoln, so you know the writing is going to be great. But just his reflections on the war and his reflections on everything from the nature of God to slavery itself are just really overpowering. That's kind of the crux of what we're looking at here, I think, is what Lincoln had to say in his second inaugural. Because he actually speculates, if you read it, it's almost like he's kind of just thinking out loud about why the Civil War, why would God, you know, let this happen? Now, Abraham Lincoln was not an extraordinarily religious individual.
At least definitely not conventionally.
Not conventionally. And he speculates at some length about, you know, why has God let this happen? Because that was a big part of what the populace was asking. Why has God let this happen? And he speculates that maybe all the blood that was spilled by slavery has not yet been paid for. Maybe that God wants every single drop of blood that was taken by slavery to be paid for in this war. And some people have really looked at that as his foreshadowing, you know, that maybe there was
of his own
death. You know, yeah. I'm not particularly superstitious, but it is an amazing sort of situation where he's speculating in his inaugural address that maybe there were things that needed to happen yet. Maybe we had not fully paid for the sin of slavery. And that becomes a huge part of the conversation, that idea that there's a real fundamental purpose to his death. Lincoln was shot on Good Friday. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't really realize that. He was shot on Good Friday. He died on Saturday. and Sunday was Easter.
Mm-hmm.
So his death, I mean, he was referred to as
the martyred president.
The martyr president. You know, yeah. The savior of the Union had become the martyr president. His death and his life and the Civil War itself took on religious connotations very quickly as the country tried to process what all this meant. There were some that suggested that maybe God realized that with malice toward none, with charity for all. It ends the second inaugural speech. There were some who feared that maybe Lincoln was signaling that he intended to be too lenient mm-hmm. with the South and that God stepped in to make sure that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
There were others who said that as, you know, Christ had saved us from our sins, maybe it was God's purpose that Lincoln would save us and his death would pay for our sin of slavery. So you're talking about really, really fundamental questions of philosophy, of religion, of the nature of things.
Well, and you also had at that same time on the other side, and I'll let either one of you jump in on this, but the development of almost a civil religion of the lost cause in the South, too. The development, it was as if on every side of this cataclysm, people were trying to make sense of just why it happened.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true, and part of it is, you know, if you're a politician, you have to keep people invested in the war. You have to keep the war effort going. You have to convey that sense of purpose that people buy into, and that flags at different times and during the Civil War, both South and North, where people do question, is this really worth it? And it's interesting because with the Emancipation Proclamation in the North, Lincoln explicitly brings in slavery mm-hmm. as a reason for the war, as well as the preservation of the Union. And that re-energizes the North. And then, of course, in the South, you have your own system, the whole debate over states' rights, slaves, et cetera, but also that sense of aggrievement that is really nurtured in the South during the war. And that sense that they're beleaguered people that is maintained afterwards, that really helps, along with that Southern sense of independence, keep people motivated to keep fighting.
Well, and it is interesting because of the, you know, at least in popular memory, the sort of binary nature of the conflict, you know, North versus South. We probably don't process just what a disruptive thing it was all across the board, that there were riots in New York City. And here in Indiana, if my understanding is correct, we pretty much operated without a legislature for two or three years because of fears that, that the legislature either would cut off funding or, in worst case, vote to secede itself. And all of that. So we don't get the fact that it wasn't just the North versus the South. This really pretty much split society apart in this country, right, Dale?
Yeah, very much so. Governor, you're right. Governor Morton pretty much ran the state on his own initiative.
And more than a few governors since then have wished they could do the same thing.
Yeah. In Indiana was very, very largely, particularly in the mid-19th century, settled by Southern people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Lincolns themselves. Abraham Lincoln, of course, grew up in Indiana, spent 14 years in Indiana. But his father came from Kentucky, and his grandfather came from Virginia. And they're very typical of people who lived in Indiana. The Indiana pioneers came from Western Virginia and Western North Carolina. In many cases, moved into Kentucky and then across the border and moved south to north. So there was a very, very southern aspect to the Indiana populace, and that was very, very, very worrisome. Not so much that Indiana would join the Confederacy, but that they would remain neutral,
mm-hmm.
that they wouldn't see it as their fight.
Mm-hmm.
There was some argument, particularly among people with Southern sympathies, that this was really a fight between Southern cotton interests and Northern New England textile mm-hmm. interests, and it didn't really have anything to do with Indiana. So the fear was not so much that Indiana would join the Confederacy or secede from the Union, but that they would just not participate. And Lincoln really couldn't afford to have Indiana and Michigan and Illinois and the other Western states
sit it out. Yeah. We have gotten a tweet from a listener named Shannon, and if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by Twitter at WFYI. You can also find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org or give us a call at 866-476-3881. Shannon's question is, can you explain what mourning crepe was? Literature makes it sound like a hazard of Victorian mourning. Either one of you.
We should have brought our textile expert along with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll have to describe it because radio is not a particularly visual medium.
Yeah.
So.
Ms. Kerber, are you familiar with the minutia of mourning dresses?
Mourning crepe?
I'm not familiar with the specific minutiae. I don't know if I can do a good job of answering the listener's questions. I will just say, as Dale said, it was very elaborate and it changed. So you had rules where the material, whether you know it was black or gray, and at what point in mourning you could go, whether you could wear certain trims, how you wore crepe, whether jet jewelry was appropriate or it was tacky to wear it with mourning. I mean, all of that was constantly shifting, so that we tend to think of it as this codified set of rules, but it really was in some ways.
Actually, it sounds like an etiquette minefield.
It was. That was very much. And so then you could separate out who had the money, the time, the social know-how to observe it in detail. So you actually have levels where at high society, you know, it's going to – you're going to know all the details. You're going to know that this is no longer acceptable, that last year was exactly what you were supposed to do. And, you know, the ladies' magazines are all full of this all this advice. But if you're working class, you can't really keep up with that. But there's still sort of a filtered down set of expectations that you're still going to wear black for a certain period of time. There's still certain things that you just can't do for that year or that period of half mourning. And Dale's got some great examples in the exhibition where people repurposed clothing or they found ways to not have to derail their everyday lives, but still give the respect to the dead, the proper behavior that was at the sentimental heart of the mourning practices.
What is the biggest misperception we have about the Civil War? Would you say, Dale?
Wow.
I'll start with you. Because as I say, there is now, and even with the Ken Burns documentary, mm-hmm. which was a fabulous piece of television, there is almost at times a kind of nostalgic glow about the thing. And, you know, it really was more a catalog of horrors than anything else.
It really was. And Susanna had mentioned photography and battlefield photography. When you have people like Alexander Gardner and Matthew Brady actually going on to the field at Antietam and taking photographs, war had a very romantic aspect to it. In the mid-19th century, images of war had a tendency to be very heroic, very romantic. You know, men standing at the top of hills with their chests out and the flag up, that's it. You know, and the rays of sunshine coming from behind them, and the clouds parting, and all that kind of stuff. And you know, Gardner went out onto the battlefield and showed what happened to a man after he'd been laying in the sun for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And it really
and hadn't had a bath for 6 months.
That's it, you know. And people don't even think about the horses. You know, yeah. I mean, just you think of the horror of Gettysburg. There were 3,000 horses, dead horses, on the battlefield at the end of the war. Can you imagine 3,000 dead horses? When that reality started to come to light, it really changed the way people of that time viewed military conflict. Unfortunately, I think we have a tendency, we get removed from those kind of things, and we fall back into those views of war as some sort of romantic adventure, something that virile young men do as part of their, you know, wonderful life experience. You know, fortunately, periodically we have films like Saving Private Ryan that come along that remind us that war has not become more romantic as time has gone on.
Yeah, one of the things I remember is at Gettysburg, since you brought that up, was just the huge challenge after the battle was over. And, you know, everybody was sort of recovering from the slaughter there was, what do you do with the dead?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Well, and I would say two points to that. One is that we tend to think of the battlefields as isolated locations. You know, there were people who lived in Gettysburg. You know, it was there was a village there. So we tend to forget that for a large part of the country, they had to deal with the physical reality of this. It wasn't just finding out about the battles and worrying about their loved ones who may be in a distant place, but the carnage was all around them. And it's hard to imagine that when you're going back and you're looking at a battlefield park or something. The other thing I would say to that is that whole challenge of dealing with the dead is something that evolves during the Civil War. And it's something that at the beginning of the war, there's no ambulance corps. There's no expectation that the dead will be identified, recovered from the field, buried properly, their relatives systematically notified. You might get a sketchy list that someone has of casualties that's likely to be wrong. It's really up to the individual soldiers to try to mark their, you know, their the others' bonds, to try to get word back to their relatives. All of that changes during the war because of public pressure, especially in the North, where you get the sanitary commissions and the beginning of the Red Cross to try to meet some of these services, where by the end of the war, the U.S. government says we have to recover the dead bodies. And then ultimately, in the face of rumors that bodies are being desecrated in the South, bodies of Union soldiers, they establish these national cemeteries and monuments. And so the whole documentation memorialization is happening during that carnage of the war. And that itself is a really fascinating process.
Well, and it deals obviously with the theme of the exhibition, right? That, you know, this was, among other things, a tremendous and ongoing education about how to deal with death on a large scale.
There was a concept of the good death. I think maybe there's always been a concept of the good death, but it was particularly important in the mid-19th century, and it involved things like last words. Mm-hmm. It involved with being surrounded by friends and loved ones when you died. Most people died in the home. In the mid-19th century America, most people died in their bed, in their home. Suddenly you had, you know, young men dying 1,000 miles from home, surrounded by people who didn't know them, you know, put into a anonymous mass grave. And there's really just an awful lot of an attempt, as Susanna was saying, to sort of bring some organization to this, to death, which was no longer a good death. There weren't that many men in the Civil War that were dying the good death. So you had, you know, people quoting last words that may or may not have even existed. You had people sending letters home about, you know, how brave and wonderful this your son was as he was dying, and how he said something glorious about his parents. There was just this real attempt to bring some sort of sense of normalcy to this incredibly chaotic and horrific situation.
We are talking about the Indiana State Museum's new exhibit about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. It is called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Loss. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are the museum's Senior Vice President, Susanna Kerber, and Curator Dale Ogden. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the Indiana State Museum's new exhibition called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Loss. My guests are the museum's senior vice president, Susanna Kerber, and curator Dale Ogden. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
So I was listening to your discussion about the good death, and I was wondering if you could talk about how you think the notion of the good death changed in light of the development of Arlington cemeteries, which, as you talked about, responded to the casualties, the mass casualties of the Civil War.
Oh, very good question. Right. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Carolyn.
Yeah, I think that is a very good question. Susanna had talked just briefly about the effort, which had never really been done before, to identify every single casualty of the Civil War, to bring them back, to not just let them die anonymous and far from home. And the establishment of the national cemeteries was a big part of that. If you've seen the movie Glory, you see the burial at the end where there are all the men, officers and enlisted men combined are all pushed into the same trench and then covered with dirt. A lot of times during the Civil War, it wasn't even, you know, that well done. It was just throw some dirt over the men in the field and hope that the wild animals wouldn't root them out. The development of the national cemeteries were very much an attempt by the society, by the culture, by the government of the time to bring some semblance of dignity to those men and some semblance of the good death to their sacrifice. It is interesting that Arlington was placed in Robert E. Lee's backyard.
Yeah, well, and there is a sort of an assumption that was a gesture of sorts aimed at the fact that he had been offered the opportunity to command the Union troops and had decided, he said at the time that I have to stand with my country and by country. Which also is one of the ways we haven't talked about yet, the perception. By country, he meant Virginia. He thought of that, his state, as his country. And it's interesting, you see an awful lot before the Civil War when people were writing about the United States of America. They wrote about it as a plural, in the plural form, and it became singular after that much more often. After that, I mean, what did the Civil War do to change our perceptions of what this country was? Susanna, I'll start with you. Big question. It's a big question, I know.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm really the one to deal with that. So, Dale, feel free to step in. I would start by saying that the changes in attitude after the Civil War were very much a process. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and there was a long history in this country of debating, just as you said, of what was the position of the states vis-a-vis the federal government.
Still goes on.
And it wasn't just a Southern debate. You know, mm-hmm. the Southerners certainly were more vocal about it, and there were various reasons in terms of the economic divergence, in terms of Southerners who had been very, very politically influential on a national level were starting to lose some of that leverage, and the expansion of slavery into the territories, all of that. That's also very much about political power. So that state identity and the regional identity, the sectionalism, the sense of a North versus a South, economic interests that might be competing, those persist after the Civil War. What happens that is in some ways unifying, in some ways problematic in the late 19th century is the reconfiguring of the memory of the Civil War from this was one where there were real interests pitted against each other. This was about slavery. This was about a decision about what kind of country we would be to this was a battle in which everybody was fighting for a cause that was true to their heart and they were all noble soldiers. And so now we can reunite around that. A narrative that very much leaves out the African-American mm-hmm. population, for example.
And women, yes.
But so that's sort of the next step in people saying, okay, well, this is how we're a unified country in that kind of popular political narrative. And again, it has all kinds of ramifications that really fall very heavily on our social organization and allow some things that really then we start resolving during the civil rights movement after World War II. So it's a very long process by which we become a country perhaps of regions with distinct identities and interests instead of a country of sections that are opposed to each other.
Dale?
Yeah, I think that kind of goes to your question previously about some of the myths that came out of the Civil War. I think one of the big myths is that...
it ended.
Exactly. You know, that brother fought brother, cousin fought cousin, and then the war ended and they all shook hands and went home and lived happily ever after. You know, that they all, you know, loved each other and became Americans and et cetera. I think maybe the later wars, you know, the First World War and the Second World War, when you have soldiers from Mississippi serving in the same platoon as soldiers from Massachusetts, I mean, I think maybe some of the lessening of sectionalism, you know, happened in those circumstances. But you're talking two, three generations, four generations down the road. There was a lot of unresolved anger, fear, argument left over after the end of 1865. We did not all shake hands. You have those wonderful photographs of the old men in the 1920s, you know, reuniting at Gettysburg, where they reach across the bloody angle and shake hands, and everybody goes, "Isn't that great? We're all one happy family now." And that became part of the mythology.
Yeah, give those guys guns though, and see what would have happened.
I mean, it goes well into the 1950s when you have the National Guard in Little Rock, Arkansas, or you have the issues that came in Alabama, the issues that we're currently seeing in some great American films right now. Those issues were left over from 90 years before.
Well, and we tend to forget too what a debt. How disruptive Lincoln's death was, too, because he was the first president to be elected to a second term in more than 30 years.
Right.
After he is killed, his successor, Andrew Johnson, is impeached and, you know, comes within one vote of being removed from office, which we've never had happen in this country. And then you've got the troops in the South until, 1876, right? The election of 1876, for the Republicans to get Rutherford Hayes installed, they have to make a deal to pull the troops out.
Right.
So, it sounds like it's just an absolutely chaotic period in American history.
I think very much so. You have state legislatures in some areas being in large part taken over by African-American legislators. You have many, many African-Americans elected to state legislatures in places like Louisiana.
Yeah.
Disruptive is, I think, one word that you could use to
mildest,
describe that situation.
It's the mildest and least judgmental, probably.
And then you have the incredible backlash to that fact in Reconstruction and all the laws that were implemented throughout the South to essentially try to take things back to the way they were before the war was fought. I think the Civil War probably left at least as many questions unanswered as it answered. It answered the fact that there would not be involuntary servitude as a legal precept any longer, but it didn't really change some of the facts on the ground.
No. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Kate, and if you would like to reach out to us by Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org. Or if you want to go old school and just give us a call, you can call us at 866-476-3881. Kate's question is it inconceivable to think that Vanderbilt had a hand in the start of the Civil War? It certainly profited his growing empire. Dale, you're...
yeah. I don't know. I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Okay.
I kind of come from the point of view that often the easiest answer is the correct answer.
Yeah.
I think the war was fundamentally about a disagreement over the nature of the country, the role of the federal government. Could the federal government dictate to the individual states how their society would function? You had mentioned that in, mm-hmm. in many, many instances, Robert E. Lee being a great example, people felt that their state was where their loyalty lie. And the question was, is that true? You know, is the federal government the preeminent authority in our civic life, or can you have different laws in different states depending on the attitudes of those states themselves? We're still, to some extent, having that argument. That argument's not ever been definitively settled. Slavery was the product of that argument. That was what they, you know, mm-hmm. the issue that brought everything to a head. But basically, it was an argument over whether or not the federal government had the right and the authority and the power to tell Mississippi that they couldn't have slaves, to tell South Carolina, to tell Alabama. It was about the role of the federal government. It was about the nature of our union. I think that was what the Civil War was really about.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana State Museum's new exhibit on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War called So Costly a Sacrifice, Lincoln and Loss. Question, where did you come up with the title for the exhibit? I mean, I love it, but yeah. it's wonderful.
Actually, the title, I think, was the hardest thing we had to deal with because this is really a complex exhibition. We're asking a lot from our visitors on this. We're asking them to sort of make that leap from the culture of the 19th century to the Civil War to the meaning of Lincoln's death. So it's not real straightforward like most museum exhibitions are, I don't think. We're asking people to sort of understand concepts, and that can be a little challenging when it comes to museum exhibitions because we're dealing with hard three-dimensional objects. But we wanted... The exhibit is not just about Lincoln and not just about the assassination. It's really not just about the assassination. So we couldn't just say, you know, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. It's not just about mortality in the 19th century. It's not just about the Civil War. There are different aspects that we're trying to convey in this exhibition. So you have to get Lincoln in there because he's central to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea of loss, whether it's the loss of a child to tuberculosis in the 1850s, whether it's the loss of a father in the Civil War. The idea of loss, I think, kind of ties what people were trying to deal with on their day-to-day life to the loss of the president of the United States, the leader of the country. So we tried to kind of tie all these disparate elements into a title that we could get out there in five words or less.
So where did the title come from?
Well, So Costly a Sacrifice comes from the letter that Lincoln sent to Lydia Bixby, which, again, I referred before to Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
If you've seen that, there's a very powerful recitation by General Marshall in that movie where he's quoting Abraham Lincoln, who sent a letter to a widow in Boston who had lost five sons in the Civil War. And he's essentially saying to her that there's nothing I can really say that's going to make this any easier for you. All I can say is that you might take some solace in the cost, such a costly sacrifice that you have laid on the altar of freedom. It's really, again, just a phenomenally powerful and compelling. Lincoln is expressing his limitations as a human being. There's nothing really I can say here. But I hope that you would take some solace in having laid so costly a sacrifice on the altar of freedom.
It doesn't seem entirely fair that, you know, the guy who was perhaps, well, there. I don't think there's much question that he was America's greatest president or America's greatest statesman also was one of America's greatest writers, too. I mean, you think of the phrasing and the way he was able to encapsulate things. I asked you earlier, what's the greatest misperception about the Civil War? What's the greatest misperception about Lincoln?
That he wasn't really a politician in the negative connotation that we attach to politicians these days. I loved Spielberg's movie on Lincoln. I thought it was fabulous. Mm-hmm. And the best thing about it was it presented him as a human being and a political animal. I mean, Lincoln was not above making deals. He was not above, you know, dealing, getting down and dirty in the sense of mid-19th century American politics. If he had to buy a vote, he bought a vote. if he had to make a compromise, he made a compromise. Lincoln was, I would agree with the statement that Lincoln was our greatest president and one of the great human beings in world history, in my opinion. He was also very, very successful. He knew how to exercise the levers of power. And he was one of the most successful individuals at doing that. It's just really hard to imagine somebody else. Well, Buchanan couldn't do it. I don't think Johnson would have done it. The presidents that preceded Lincoln didn't force mm-hmm. the issue. It took a man like him to really make the hard calls.
Yeah, we have a comment from a listener named Gary via Facebook. Says, I have seen some information that separates section of the country into different religious groups. The East, or Yankees, appeared to be Calvinist with Indiana, etc., has different majorities. Now, is the USA just another Calvinist country instead of Catholic, etc.? You know, it changed to what you were saying earlier, religious perceptions as well. After talking about this, you know, give people real quickly, when does the exhibition start, and, you know, when can they start seeing all of this great stuff, Susanna?
Well, we'd certainly love people to come to the exhibition opening, and you can get tickets and information on our website, which is indianamuseum.org. The opening reception is on Friday evening, February 6th, and then it opens to the public February 7th, and it will run through July 5th.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a fascinating conversation. Susanna, Dale, I really appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Also,
thank you.
Appreciate all of our listeners who sent us some great questions. We're going to be back on Tuesday when we are going to be talking about opening adoption records. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.